The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
As some of you know, I lived and worked in Nicaragua before coming to the Bay Area in 1998, and then co-founded Faithful Fools with Reverend Kay Jorgensen, who was the social justice minister with this congregation. I arrived in Nicaragua with my Franciscan community in November of 1990. The Sandinistas, the revolutionary movement that governed after they had overthrown the dictator Somoza in 1979, had lost elections earlier that year. A U.S.-backed government was back in place. The Contra War that our government had waged to overthrow the Sandinistas then came to an end, and the country we arrived in was worn down by decades of war. 50% of the population was under the age of 15. Grocery stores were barren from the embargoes. Unemployment and malnutrition were prevalent. Settlements with tin and wooden makeshift shacks were bursting up around the outskirts of Managua as people came to the city seeking employment. At the same time, there was a strength amidst this weariness and an unrelenting determination that was still very palpable. As we came to know people, especially folks who were part of the base Christian communities or coffee, art, or farming cooperatives, we couldn't help but be inspired by the individual and the communal commitment that was still alive. People would tell us stories of the 50-year struggle to overthrow the dictatorship. Once Somoza had left the country, the Sandinistas began to take steps to bring about the changes they had fought for all those years. People from all levels of society participated. They organized a health campaign to eradicate polio and a literacy campaign because nearly 75% of the rural population was illiterate. It is said that 60,000 high school and college age youth and 30,000 adults were trained and sent throughout the countryside to teach people to read and write. The campesinos and the campesinas would speak to how empowering it was when they learned to write their own name. The music that inspired people in the struggle to overthrow Somoza and to keep fighting throughout the Contra War was still being sung in the churches and could be heard blasting from the stereos in people's homes. The lyrics of the Misa Campesina, the peasant mass, sang of a God who was a liberator, of Jesus as the young person who changed your flat tire at the roadside, of Christ who was risen in every arm outstretched to defend the people against the exploitation of the rulers. In first thinking about today's service, I shared with Sam that I wanted it to be on revolution. I wanted to think and reflect about the fact that here we are, 45 years after what is called the triumph, and the Sandinista government, the liberating force of 1979, has become a dictatorship itself, imprisoning and exiling people, many of whom were their comrades and fought with them in the wars. I think at some level, as you've heard already, a bit of a weary heart, I think I was seeking to feel that reviving, invigorating, communal, inspiring spirit that I would feel in the plaza in Managua when we'd gather every July 19th on the anniversary of the triumph. There was singing and there was dancing. And in the complexity, anger, and pain of the time we are living in right now, in this city and in our world, I long for that energy that comes with singing and dancing and feeling like we're moving as one mass for change. Sam contemplated my title of revolution for a moment and then said, "How about we do the service on change? We fools speak of being a community that works for personal and social change. Now, change isn't quite as sexy as revolution, but Sam's suggestion of reflecting on change was right on, for that is what revolution is about. Making fundamental change, making deep structural change within us and around us. And that is the center of our life and work as faithful fools, rooting ourselves in our belief of the worth and inherent dignity of all people. We seek to do fundamental, personal, and social change. As we say in our mission statement, through art, through our educational work with students in schools, through our steady work of advocacy, and in our daily and often years-long work with individuals. And is it also the work that happens here in this congregation? We do the work. We make the changes. Person by person. Action by action. Meeting by meeting. Celebration by celebration. Sam has also said at times that it often feels like this work is like pushing a string uphill, especially as they work with administrators of medical schools or with policymakers and city leaders. Yet they know, and we know, systemic change will only take root if we make the necessary fundamental changes in our lives, in the systems, and that takes time. Ray Saleha, my spiritual teacher, used to look at me and say, T, things take time. And it takes continual commitment. If we don't understand that the work required is from year to year, day to day, generation to generation, then we risk participating in and allowing harmful structures to remain. And we risk that the once oppressed will become the oppressors. So we are here now, and the work is ours to do as faithful fools, as a congregation, as citizens of this city and of this world. It can be exhausting, and hopelessness can nip at our heels. But one major thing I also learned and continue to learn from the people in Nicaragua is that dancing and singing and inspiring and encouraging one another with words and affirmations is essential to keeping our spirit strong for the work that needs to be done. As we heard in Amanda Gorman's story, Change Sings, together we are a chant that rises and rings, and there is hope where our change sings. This is the revolutionary way.
Oh, good morning to you. Good morning to you. You know, today's theme was person by person by person, a change. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what I should speak to today. And I tried this, and I tried that. And my academic brain couldn't do it. My narrative brain couldn't do it. My solace brain couldn't do it. And my, I don't know, whatever brain couldn't do it. And I thought to myself, I need a change. I'm a person, and I need a change. So I thought I would just bring to you the change that I need right now. These are difficult days in lots of different ways for all of us. And so sometimes all we can do is shift within ourselves. And I find I'm not very good at doing that by myself. I need somebody else. So I turn to some of my great heroes who create beauty, because I know when I need a change, I need beauty. So I'm going to introduce you to my friend Iris Murdoch. You may have met her at a party someplace before, maybe discussed her over a cocktail or breakfast. If you haven't heard of Iris Murdoch, please meet her. She is an amazing novelist, a philosopher too, but an amazing novelist who brings us characters who are strikingly human, strikingly like me, and maybe you'll find like you. Her characters, if they are mean and violent, are also capable of love. If they are flighty, they are capable of moments of commitment, not always. And some of her characters are shallow, really only interested in their own appearance and how much people love them. But even those people have a moment in which they have a great deal of depth. So I'm going to read you a little scene in which this book, The Bell, one of the main characters, Dora, who happens to be one of the most superficial people you could ever hope to meet in a novel, and she has this moment. She is trying to decide if she's going to spend the rest of her life with her older husband, who is sort of, quite abusive, quite angry all the time, and she can't quite figure out why she keeps going back to him. But she's going to think about it on this particular day. So she, living in England, goes down to London to visit the National Gallery. And this is what happened. Dora hadn't especially intended to visit the National Gallery, but once she was there, she went in. It was as good as any place to decide what to do. So she climbed the stairs and wandered away into the eternal springtime of the air-conditioned rooms. Dora had been in the National Gallery 1,000 times, and the pictures were almost as familiar to her as her own face. Passing between them, as through a well-loved grove, she felt a calm descending upon her. She wandered a little, watching with compassion those poor visitors who were armed with guidebooks and were peering anxiously at all the masterpieces. Dora did not need to peer. She could look, as one can at last when one knows a great thing very well, confronting it with a dignity which it has itself conferred on the moment. She felt the pictures belonged to her and reflected ruefully that they were about the only thing that did. Vaguely, consoled by the presence of something welcoming and responding in the place, her footsteps took her to the various shrines at which she had worshipped so often before, the great light places of Italian pictures, more vast and southern than anything in the real south of Europe. The angels of Botticelli, radiant as birds, delighted as gods, curling like the tendrils of a vine. The glorious carnal presence of Susanna Fermant. The tragic presence of Margarita Tripp. The solemn world of Piero del Francesca, with its early morning colors, the enclosed and gilded world of Crivelli. Doris stopped at last in front of the Gainsborough's picture of his two daughters. Those children step through a wood, hand in hand, their garments shimmering, their eyes serious and dark, their two pale heads, round full buds, alike and yet unalike. Dora was always moved by these pictures. Today she was moved, but in a new way. She marveled with a kind of gratitude that they were still here, and her heart was filled with love for those pictures, their authority, their marvelous generosity, their splendor. It occurred to her that here at last was something real and something perfect. Who had said that about perfection and reality being in the same place? Here was something which her consciousness could not wretchedly devour. And by making it part of her fantasy, she couldn't make it worthless. Even Paul, her husband, she thought, only existed now as someone she had dreamt about, or else as a vague external menace, never fully encountered or truly understood. But the pictures were something real outside of her, which spoke to her kindly and yet in a sovereign tone. Something superior and good whose presence destroyed the dreary translake solipsism of her earlier mood. When the world had seemed to be subjective, it had seemed to be without any interest or value. But now there was something else in it after all. These thoughts, not clearly articulated, flitted through Dora's mind. She had never thought about the pictures in this way before. Nor did she draw now any particular moral. Yet she felt she had had a revelation. She looked at the radiant, somber, tender, powerful canvas of Gainsborough and felt a sudden desire to go down on her knees before it, embracing it, shedding tears. Dora looked anxiously around her, wondering if anyone had noticed her transports. Although she had not actually prostrated herself, her face must have looked unusually ecstatic, and the tears were in fact starting to form in her eyes. She found that she was alone in the room, and she smiled, restored to a more calm enjoyment of her own wisdom. She gave a last look at the painting, still smiling as one might smile in a temple, favored, encouraged, and loved, and then she turned and went on about her business. When I feel low, I need stories like this. So I thought today I would share this story with you. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, you.
Friends.
We give a big thank you to all who caught the spirit of You've Got a Friend in We and submitted your pledges during the initial phase of the annual canvas. You got us off to a flying start.
And as of this morning, we are 77%, that's a good lucky number, on the way to the goal of 750,000. Hooray!
Oh no, that means we're not quite there, but we are ever closer to the dreaded begging phase of the canvas. I can't cry on cue like Jimmy Swaggart, or even get down on my bum knee. What are we going to do, Sherry?
Well, there are still about 90 members who have not pledged.
Did they run out of gas on the way to the pledge box? Did their dogs eat their pledge forms?
No. There are lots of good reasons that people haven't submitted their forms. You know, some people have been out of town. Some people have pressing matters to attend to. The good news is there is still time. Recently, Reverend Vanessa sent out emails, and you and I sent out snail mails. Today, those are called letters, to the unpledged. And there will be more follow-ups until we have reached everyone. We will not quit here.
Oh, I know. We will not quit here. But the question is, are we far enough along to have champagne and cupcakes today in the courtyard?
Yes, we are. And we will draw the names of 2 lucky people who managed to get their pledges in before midnight on March 31st. They will be the winners of 2 different stays at Lake Tahoe Residences. So join us in the courtyard after the service.
Oh, and yes, we will have pledge forms available if you need one.